Welcome to the Pendulum Insight Podcast. This is a show for deal makers in the blockchain business, where we meet the players who are changing the game today and get their insight into everything from the red tape to the raise. This is your host, Colton Moffitt. Let's get started. Hey everybody, I'm joined here today by Jared Politis, and he is the a venture partner at Blockteam Ventures, and he's been involved with over 50 different blockchain-related projects now and raised over $400 million in that process. So Jared, why don't you tell us a bit more about yourself, why you got into the blockchain economy, and a little bit of your history with Blockteam Ventures and where that's going now.
Yeah, sure. First of all, Colton, thank you for having me. Super excited to be here. Blockteam Ventures, to give you guys a quick overview, is a traditional VC fund based in Los Angeles. I was based in New York when we kind of founded it, so we had this bi-coastal model, but pretty standard in the sense 220 model. So, 2% management fee, 20% profit on anything on the returns of the fund. So, extremely standard. Based on industry standards, so nothing too special about that. But we are blockchain focused, so only investing in blockchain projects. We started off primarily on the token side. Now we're opening it up to equity. We're looking at everything from the very typical infrastructure protocol plays that I think every fund is drooling over at the moment, to reverse ICOs, so companies with existing revenue that are looking to integrate blockchain technology, and they're doing that via maybe an ICO or an STO, so just to raise new capital, kind of spin off or branch off. And the third kind of, I would say, bucket that we're looking at is transformational companies, so companies that have the potential to really disrupt, a big industry. So this is like your next Airbnb, potentially, next Uber, so like something really disruptive. Obviously, the latter is higher risk, but, if everything works out, they're going to bring more rewards. That's kind of how we're analyzing it. So I got involved. I met the two general partners before Blockteam was a fund. It was more of a blockchain community. So we had a Facebook group. All of us, the three of us, were working as advisors on various projects. We intersected at one project, got to know each other. We're pretty heavily investing at that time. And then decided, okay, let's legitimize this. Between our networks, we were getting access to really interesting deals and getting to know founders early on. And so we had kind of that infrastructure set up, but we were still investing kind of like the crypto world does, right? Where at that time it was like a pool where you just get friends together, you sign a contract, you send Ether, which is completely standard practice, but it's not really, you're not a fund. There's no, structure behind that. So that's why we did essentially created Blockteam, and it's been an incredible ride, through the year. Even though there's been a down market, we're still pretty optimistic about where the industry is going. So,
yeah,
pretty excited.
That's cool. And on that last point, it's definitely interesting to see that the traders, the day trader minded people, are just constantly looking. When's it going to go again? When's it going to go? And I see all of the stability in the price as actually kind of a positive message, and that it hasn't completely tanked, and all interest has not gone away, despite that large bubble event that we saw happen at the end of last year, beginning of this year. So I see that as a good
help. I agree. 100%.
Cool.
I think even the stability of Bitcoin over the last 4 to 6 weeks has been refreshing, right?
Yeah. I could actually accept a payment in Bitcoin and not be thinking speculatively, but actually think, okay, this is going to be something that I can hold on to for a minute to see what happens if I don't need to go and immediately apply it to something. So that's
right,
cool.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, spending it. I mean, who would have thought?
Yeah, I know. You can actually spend your Bitcoin, right?
Yeah, indeed. This is a new world. So I wanted to get into one of the first things that caught my attention. You know how on LinkedIn it'll show you if one of your connections comments on something that it thinks you're interesting? And you had described a sort of interesting trend where you've got these blockchain events popping up, and mm-hmm. they're basically selling the idea of, oh, there's going to be all these investors there for your ICO, and
right.
kind of taking advantage of people. I mean, that's the tone that I got anyway, is that they're charging a lot of money for access, and it's kind of like a new racket in the industry. Would you elaborate that a bit for us?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, if you look at the progression of the industry, I would say over the last year, we had obviously the run up in December, January kind of dipped. It still stayed pretty consistent. If you look like the ICO fundraising numbers through May, even in May, I think Ethereum hit 800 again. So we had this kind of recovery. So people once again were optimistic going into the summer. It wasn't until the end of the summer where things really started to dry up on the retail side. Mm. So through that process, I would say, you know, 2017 was the year of the retail investor largely, plus, you know, some syndicates. The first quarter of this year, just based on what I saw, was all syndicates, pools, like primarily groups of people that were funding, and then a little trickle off into the retail market. So what this created was, you know, a bunch of companies looking to fundraise, but wanting access to the right parties, right? So that was the disconnect, the gap. How do we access a syndicate or a pool that's in Eastern Europe that maybe they're miners and they have a lot of, you know, access crypto and they want to get into different projects? How do we get to them? And that kind of started the first, you know, I would say informal investor outreach process. So people, advisors, and other service providers trying to connect that, those two dots. Mm. As we moved into the summer, it became, you know, quickly a private sale game, right? So rather than having these pools and syndicates who invested largely in Ethereum, so they were kind of beat up in the summer, mm-hmm. you had private investors. And these are people that invest sometimes in fiat, right? So they're not always crypto holders. Right. So think more traditional when you think private. You're thinking VC funds, institutions, family offices, things like that. To access those people from a crypto background with no traditional finance background, especially if you're not in like New York or a major finance capital, is extremely tough. So right. people started hiring service providers to put on, you know, private dinners, to put on road shows, so setting up small events at each city, attracting their network of investors, and then ideally, you know, some of them fund companies at these events. In theory, it's amazing. It's great. There's no way these service providers can guarantee capital is going to be raised. You can't force somebody to cut a check. So that's fine. I mean, I'm not against, like, you know, a lot of people complain, well, how do I know the ROI is there? Well, you can't expect the organizer to guarantee that. The problem I have is when it starts crossing into fraud territory, and that's what started happening, right? Especially with Asia. There's this reverse gold rush going to Asia to fundraise, but then you'd go to Korea and there'd be this private dinner you paid $15,000 for. There's probably 25 people in the crowd. You were told they're all active investors, but then if you really dig deeper, it's like the organizer's cousin, his three brothers, their best friends are sitting in the crowd. They split the 10 grand at the end of the night. And then you have no clue because you're in this foreign country. You just, you know, there's like a trust. You expect, yeah, how do you know? And then if nothing happens, they fall back on, well, hey, we couldn't guarantee anything. We just got the people in the room and it's your job to close it. That brought out a lot of bad actors.
Yeah.
And if you mix that with just a bad market in general and not a lot of activity on the fundraising side, it creates a situation where, you know, the majority of these roadshows are not worth it. And right. that's what I was calling out. It's like, that's not the golden ticket, you know, yeah. going to Asia and having 10 dinners and you'll raise 20 million. Like it doesn't work like that.
Sounds nice though, doesn't it?
It's like, well, yeah,
it's very Hollywood, very very fun, but
yeah,
it's tough to do due diligence outside the country you're from. You have to find.
It is tough.
Yeah. Hmm. All right. Well, I mean, I really appreciate you expanding on that because the concept of it and how it was being done is something that I think could still be alluring to people. People might still be falling for that stuff. So it's definitely something to look out for. And if you're listening to this, maybe think twice when somebody offers you the chance to spend just 15 grand to get 15 million, you might have to be a little more careful than that.
I know. And it's, you know, in theory, it's awesome if you can get a lot of, if you know the real investors in a room, but mm-hmm. to execute that, just to expand a little bit more, mm-hmm. You would need to, in my opinion, educate the investors on what the project is. and filter them out and only invite the ones that are excited about the, you know, listening and learning more about the project. So this is like a long pipeline. It's not something you can put together in 48 hours. Like a lot of providers, you know, just kind of wing it as they go city to city. So in theory, if you can trust the provider and you know some of the investors, and my biggest piece of advice is like ask for references and talk to other founders. Mm-hmm. And just pick your brain on how the event was, who was there, what happened after, and then you'll be safe, right? But you have to do the your due diligence on all the events.
Gotcha. Okay, that's good to know. So that actually brings me to one of my other questions I had in mind, which mm-hmm. was in your October tips for ICO founders, you said the retail market is dead. Stop paying for email lists, ratings, listings, overpriced sponsorships, any gimmicky offer. Mm-hmm. And you also said something similar in an interview with Influencive. Right. So, you know, you mentioned that how the end of 2017 was kind of the retail investors' time with everything. And then now it moved to those private sales in the middle of this year. And that's kind of where that middle ground is where this roadshow sort of scam arose, where it's not necessarily that they intended to be scams. It's just kind of maybe a misalignment of expectations and then people preying on that. So to go back to that, though, the retail market being dead and those kinds of marketing, I think a lot of the early ICOs were able to just do it like it was a Kickstarter campaign, maybe.
Right, right.
So why don't you tell us a little more about that and where you see those differences expanding in the future?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, ICOs were, you know, initiated around like a crowdfunding concept, right? So that's exactly like you said. So that was purely like, you know, it gave everybody an equal chance to get in early into a project that had potential on a token basis. So this new economy got brought up. It worked out great through, I would even argue, like all of 2017. I mean, the returns on ICOs were just incredible. Now, for the average investor that didn't have crypto experience, like doing an ICO investment was confusing, kind of, right? You had to have a wallet, you have to transfer to their wallet. There's this kind of not gray area, but there's definitely a risk that you're taking by sending money to an unknown party, right? A lot of times there's like maybe a smart contract, which you could validate the transfer happened, but sometimes there was, you know, not even a contract. You're just sending money to a private wallet and, you know, ideally getting tokens issued the same day. Sometimes there's a little delay and that was it. Yeah. That was great. The problem that happened was as the retail market and the market in general slowed down through the end of the year, and I would say especially this year, the liquidity in the market is just so low, right? And we talked about this offline a little bit. The good news about that is like we're seeing some stability, right? Some price stability in general across different various, I would say, large cap tokens. Mm-hmm. But when you have low volume, it creates two problems. And this is contrary to stability, ironically enough. Whales can come in and manipulate the market, which I think we've seen a couple times this year, at least. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is it's very hard to do an ICO as a retail investor and find liquidity in the market after it's been listed. Mm-hmm. There's just not enough money in the market. So what's happening, it creates this like panic sell right upon listing where somebody's just trying to get 2X, right? Like a 2X is great in this market. A lot of times, if you can even recover your initial capital, you would take that over the last 3 or 4 months. So everybody just runs and they sell and they sell and they sell. And the retail investors got really burned, I would say, in general, investing in the market. Plus, you know, if they caught the hype at the top, obviously. Mm-hmm. And then doing a lot of ICOs recently. So I would say there was a fleeting of confidence in the retail market. And until that confidence is built up, again, and there's, you know, I think some more infrastructure in place for ICOs or for fundraising in general, we're going to see a disconnect. And I don't think we're going to see a rush back in. Now, the counter argument to that is people have short memories. The second there's a bull run, we're going to see the same people jump back in and plus more people, which I tend to agree with in general. I mean, I think if there's a bull run this time, it's going to be for the right reasons, right? We're seeing a lot of the big news that's coming out right now. Mm-hmm. The ETS with December 20th, I think, Goldman and Circle stablecoin, just I think Coinbase just is going to adopt it, which is awesome. So I think the bull run this time around is going to be for the right reasons. And if the retail market comes, ideally, you know, there's a longevity to this process. It's not going to be a 30-day December 2017 I think it was 17 days that Bitcoin went from, no, wait, I could be getting it right. I think it was 5 days, 5 or 17 days. I don't know. It was a short span. Bitcoin went from 5 to 20 in like less than 3 weeks. And it was, you know, it's incredible.
It was quite a fascinating thing to watch because I discovered, you know, Bitcoin, I want to say in, it couldn't have been any later than 2013. I want to say, yeah, around then, you know, and I played around with it a little bit. I spent some, I changed some to Litecoin, spent some, you know, it was
an interesting thing,
kind of learned the technology. And then I kind of just left it alone for a while. You know, I was traveling around a lot, wasn't thinking much about it. And then suddenly everybody's like, have you heard of Bitcoin? You need to buy Bitcoin. Man, I threw away some hard drives, I'll tell you that much.
But, Oh, man.
Things happen, you know, and what you're talking about though, with that kind of emotional investing that, you know, the retail investor concept, they're going to flood in when there is a bull run. Sure. And you're saying also a lot of time they lose out regardless of how things go, whether it's an ICO or it's just them going and loading up their credit cards onto an exchange or whatever. People get excited. And that brings me to one of the other important questions, which we're going to have some fun with, the concept of the ICO versus the STO, how they differ. Is that difference important? And your thoughts on the need to be an accredited investor versus you go to some countries and that kind of concept is totally different.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a lot to touch on here. This is going to be a fun one. But so I think I tend to agree with the general opinion that STOs are going to be the future. I really think that. I think we're still a few months away, 3 to 6 months until the infrastructure is fully built. So if you go right now, like these awesome platforms like T0, Polymath, they're not live yet, right? So you can't actively trade or go buy a security token. So I think there's still a gap there. Once we validate that model, you know, people can go out and start buying security tokens backed by real assets, then I think there's going to be a lot of excitement. I think STOs are perfect to attract the institutional investors that people have been talking about for 6 months that haven't been active, contrary to what everybody thinks. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of money that has been earmarked and kind of set aside for digital assets as a new asset class. So that includes, you know, early stage investing, it includes cryptocurrency, Bitcoin buying, holding. Mm-hmm. You know, so these people, this is going to be a perfect infrastructure for. A year lockup on those STOs in the US, that's fine, right? That's like standard. An investor coming from that world, that's not going to scare them. Mm-hmm. A year lockup for a typical ICO investor is like an eternity, and I don't think anybody wants to do it, and it's completely foreign. Right. So I think, in my opinion, the struggle, the challenge is going to be providing both markets, right? I think STOs are super important. They're going to provide, you know, access for the right people in a secure environment, but it is cutting out the majority of the retail interest and the people that are bullish about this ecosystem and this industry that aren't, you know, accredited maybe, or maybe they don't have access to US banking or, you know, KYC document, who knows, right? There's a whole list of situations. So I would like to see an ecosystem where both kind of thrive, the utility model, or internationally, there's a different way of doing things. And then the STO market, largely stemming from the US, is kind of self-supporting itself at that point. Accredited investor status, I think, is completely ridiculous. I think it's outdated. In theory, look, you don't want your grandmother getting called at midnight by some scam artist saying, hey, first mortgage, we're going to pay you triple your money, but, you know, whatever the case is. And like, you're shit out of luck, right? Like, we don't want that to happen. The issue I have is, let's take an example. You get a PhD in math and you want to teach high school math. Like, that's your goal. That's your passion. Mm-hmm. So you make 60, 70K a year. You're like that. You're never accredited. That's it. But my, you know, uncle from Argentina can come to Brooklyn and open up 3 pizzerias that net him 300K a year for a couple years. And this guy's accredited. Maybe he hasn't, you know, completed high school. Mm. Just a hypothetical, right?
Right.
By that law, my uncle is deemed more educated and deemed more, not worthy, but capable of making an investment decision based on his income, more so than the PhD in math, right? Mm. That doesn't make any sense. Plus, if you take like lottery tickets and all these other arguments people are throwing out, I think what, $20 billion was spent on lottery tickets in the US? Like, yeah. If I can't go invest $10 in an ICO, like it just doesn't make sense to me. It just doesn't make sense. So I think it needs, there needs to be a revamp. And I don't know if that's in the form of like a standardized test. Hey, if you want to invest in ICOs, go take this test. The SEC or somebody enforces the test. It's a random generated test, so you can't just copy, you know, answers from everybody. And then once you pass the test, guess what? Okay, you have enough financial literacy to, you know, to go out and make an ICO investment without all the stress, right?
Interesting.
I don't know if that's the answer, but that's what I would recommend, something like that.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's an interesting point you make about the uncle with the pizzerias versus the relative with the PhD in math, right? One of them is more qualified to understand cryptography, right? But someone could also argue that the guy who has successfully operated a business for that long with multiple locations maybe is more qualified to make an investment decision just on having the ability to handle his emotions, right? And that can be what gets away from people. Now, of course, PhDs in math aren't known for their emotional volatility, but you know, as somebody who personally, I didn't complete college, I would be a little bit, I certainly wouldn't want it to be something where your education was factored in.
No, absolutely not. That's why I said the standardized test, right?
Right. Yeah. And that makes sense. I also get the people saying, look, just take all the regulation away. The whole concept was to be, you know, letting anybody do it. I get that too. I get that people want to be protected. I'd say if it were me, it falls somewhere along the lines of, if you lose your ass because you invested in something and you didn't understand it, that's kind of on you. If the company or the people promoting it, if they commit fraud or they violate regulations in some way, that's on them. They broke the law or they need to be fined or something. And so the criminality of it is the responsibility of the person doing that. But if you lose your money because you invested poorly, that's kind of on you. And what we should be doing, if we're going to talk about a we that should be doing anything, is looking at financial education as a priority over limiting who can invest. But I really 100%. Appreciate your insight on that. And if there were to be such a standardized test, and you say maybe issued by the SEC, and they would do that, how do you think would be the way to assess that capability best? You know, since you are involved with these projects and you do have a background in these things, both in detecting fraud and in investment.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I couldn't have said it better how you just explained it, with kind of like the responsibility is on the company. And if there's an attempt at a fraud, then that's clearly an issue that needs to, you know, needs to be addressed, and people need to be protected from these kinds of people. With the standardized test, I mean, look, I think it's almost like when you go to an amusement park and you sign a waiver that if you get injured due to your activities, you know, it's kind of on you at that point, right? There's no liability. And I think there has to be some kind of, you know, self-regulation as well, where you admit to yourself, like, this is a risky endeavor I'm about to get into. It's speculative largely. There's a chance that I could lose money. I mean, I've lost money on ICOs, sometimes 90% this year. I do this for a living, but, you know, it happens. So, I mean, nobody's immune to it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter how, you know, deep you are into this thing. So yeah, I think after, you know, there's kind of that aspect of like admitting, you know, responsibility for the investment you're about to take and understanding the risks, but then also like going through, like, I think they should educate on what an ICO is, you know, what to look out for, you know, red flags. I think that should be a whole section. Mm. Does this ICO, you know, are there inconsistencies in this part or this part, or do they have, you know, any publicly facing things of concern, I think is one aspect. Mm-hmm. So that's one angle of it. Then, I mean, it could go really deep. Yeah. I don't know. This could end up being like a Series 7 or something, like a 3 to 6 hour test, which I don't think it should be that hard. But I think educating what is an ICO or an STO, what you can expect, the risks to look out for, and then some stats about, you know, what's happened in the past, just so people are aware of, like, you know, this market changes so quick and it's not a sure thing. And maybe it's as simple as that, you know?
Hmm. That's definitely a good angle on it. I think that if we have to balance the ideological imperative of most people who are originally interested in crypto and as a technology, before it was even cryptocurrency. I mean, you've got this kind of anarcho-capitalist leaning group of people the whole idea was to get rid of banks, get rid of government and all that. And here's our way to do it. And then there's, well, we want to be involved too, but we don't really want to lose all our money and we do not want to piss off the government. So you have to have some regulation there to play nice, and it's not going to grow and it's not going to see any widespread adoption unless you can appeal to those people who do want those protections.
Oh, you're right. You're right. I gotta throw in this Reddit quote that I read that I had pulled up, just that goes on that line. So it was an article about BACT, B-A-K-K-T, the trading December 12th. Mm-hmm. Bitcoin daily futures contracts start December 12th, right? So massive news. It's covered everywhere. The first comment is, sorry, accredited investors only, not for us plebs. Anyhow, this should have paved the way for all sorts of crypto ETFs in the future. The next comment, the sad irony here, the entire world had their chance to buy Bitcoin cheap and they didn't. Now the usual assholes are going to get there first and everybody else will get sloppy seconds, right? And it's like, but it's what's happening. It's like, so what you said is like this infrastructure is being built. Of course, if you've been in crypto and you're, cypherpunk and you have like from the mid 90s and you're into that movement, like you should be okay. But there's like this whole new wave of people that share that ideology that maybe didn't get in early enough. And it's kind of true. It's like, they're going to have to go in now with like the Goldman Sachs in the world. And that's, it's ironic, right? It's
it is
contrary to what it's, I mean,
it was, I was talking to some guys recently at a kind of Bitcoin mixer thing. And I said, you know, the banks aren't the enemy. Right, the government is not necessarily the enemy. It's just they're doing what they do. They're doing what they've always done, and the question will be, how are you going to operate under the understanding that that's going to continue? You know, you can still go and be involved in these projects. If you're frustrated with the way that one thing like Bitcoin is going, you can go and get involved with the privacy-oriented coins. You can still go and get involved with an ICO and those kinds of projects. They're not going to ask for your KYC AML stuff,
right?
But then when you lose all your money, you can't go cry to the government then. You know, it's what's good for the
you're right.
So
no, you're absolutely right.
That's one thing. And you know, you talked about if someone does want to take that responsibility and take that risk, they should be looking for the red flags. And, you know, you were an analyst for the FBI. You were looking into securities fraud. How has that experience influenced how you work now in these 50 different projects you've been an advisor on? What are some of those red flags and how has that whole experience influenced you?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So, I mean, ironically, I was doing pump and dump investigations, was you know, my specialty for a year and a half. It was in the FBI 2 years, but I think took a couple months on board. So a year and a half, I did pump and dump small cap market manipulation. So the same kind of charts where, you know, hey, I'm going to issue some shares or AKA tokens to my aunt or some distant relative and distribute them and then pump this thing via PR marketing or press releases. And back in like the small cap days, 8 years ago, it was usually like email newsletters that was kind of the main channel people would use. In the very earliest of days, it was Yahoo message board. So, you know, I think the brainchild of this created, you know, 30, 40 different accounts on Yahoo and every day would just go start pumping the stock he just bought. It made like something crazy, like 700K and, you know, relatively short period of time. It's a really young guy. So it's been happening. The same kind of stuff now. I mean, like it's a very manipulated market for better or worse, right? I mean, and that's not saying companies are behind that. A lot of times it's whoever's holding the most amount of tokens in a, you know, whatever token it is, like they have the power to move it up and down. And when you start getting up into like the really large caps, like Bitcoin, if you have the power to move Bitcoin or Ethereum, that trickles down and affects the whole market in general, right? At this point, it's still very interconnected. That's problematic. So there is manipulation at the top. Obviously, it's hard to track this. On the red flag side, I think the biggest distinction, the most important thing when you're analyzing a project or an ICO is, and we kind of talked about this, is the intent to defraud, right? Mm-hmm. So when we were looking at cases at the FBI, that was the biggest thing, right? It's okay. Maybe a guy had a bad run. A company had a bad run. Three or four of their partnerships fell through. Their revenue got hit. Their market got affected by a law, external factors, and now they're bankrupt and a bunch of investors lost their money. Can you go cry foul play? Probably not, right? If everything checks out. Now, if a company takes investor money and has no intention of doing anything productive with it or following the roadmap, and goes out and buys Ferraris and disappears, or ships this really shitty V1 product and says, well, we tried, sorry. Then you can make the argument that there was a clear intent to defraud. And the second you get that is where just run, right? And that's why you have to look at small things. Did the teams check out? What were they doing before? Do they have subject matter expertise in whatever vertical they're going into in the ICO? Do they have a product? who's invested in them, who's done due diligence. There's a whole like, you know, checklist of things I would look at. But I think in general, you know, people have this really aggressive, which is understandable, mentality against ICOs in the sense that if 6 months goes by after the ICO and there's no product, people start yelling scam. I don't think that's fair. I think you have to give an ICO, a company, a certain window of time to prove themselves, at least following a roadmap or shipping a product, because it's not easy building a product. Like coming from that tech background, like product building is tough, right? You can always ship a shitty product, but like shipping a good product can take a year, year and a half, right? I mean, it's a process.
Yeah.
Give them a chance. Now, if a year goes by, year and a half, there's no communication. Nobody knows if there's even an office. Half the people are on different projects. Where did the $20 million go? That's when I would start really asking questions, right, at that point.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, it's two-sided. Give the founders a chance to prove themselves, but always be critical at the same time. Just, you know, be proactive with it.
That makes sense. You know, they're dealing with a fairly technical, I mean, as far as projects and development projects can go, it's and no offense to people that make apps, you know, food delivery apps or whatever, but this is light years difference, you know, in terms of the consequences of getting it wrong. And I imagine the pressure would be pretty extreme. So someone that had no intent to defraud might end up just cracking, you know, the concept of, okay, now there's $20 or $50 million of other people's money. There's four of us. And we just really started learning how to do blockchain projects, and they all believe
it. Yeah. 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 Oh, it's common.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of times you don't mean to, and things happen anyway.
Things happen. I mean, you could argue Donald Trump's case is the same thing, right? It's like, did he really want to win? Who knows? Maybe it was just an experiment. Maybe an ICO was just a, hey, let's try it. Everybody else is doing it. Oh, wow. We just got $20 million. Now we got to build this thing. Now what do we do? You know, I don't know, not to get into politics, but it's just, you could argue that. No, I think, look, companies need to start offering buybacks and refunds. And I mean, I've seen a couple of them publicly addressed, and I think it's, you know, it's good for the market in general to have that kind of, you know, self-policing going on. I would love to see more of that. I mean, if I have a couple companies in mind that, you know, would really, really benefit from doing something like that. Yeah. Some kind of, here's something back.
Clear the air a little bit and show like, hey, look, we didn't go buy that many Ferraris. Like everything's going to be okay. You know, you said not to bring it into politics, but I'm going to anyway. So there's an interesting thing. Like, we can't take the idea of Bitcoin or cryptos or any of it. You can't really divorce the technology from the finance, from the philosophy and the politics. That's why it's so interesting. It's all those things.
Yep. Right?
And what you mentioned about Trump versus some of the other, like how you could end up in a situation that you didn't even necessarily mean to end up in. There's a pretty long history of him kind of dancing around the issue. But what's really fascinating is the involvement he had with characters like Paul Manafort or Roger Stone that whole time, who are pretty notorious, for better or worse, in just being very good at playing the game of politics. You know, again, right, for better or worse, depending on how you see their game. But it's one of those things, I think, too, where there might have been some of these ICOs doing a similar thing. Like, well, let's just see. Maybe they will give us a bunch of money. And then, oh, shit. We got work. What do we do, right? And so I guess we're the president now. But that kind of due diligence that you're talking about, who should be doing it? You know, if I'm sitting here and I'm accredited or I'm not, and I'm looking to invest in a project, I feel like my gut's telling me yes, but I don't want to trust my gut. Do I hire a PI? Do I look at a law firm? Do I look at what other investors have already invested and just count on them doing their due diligence? What do you say to that?
Good point. Yeah. If you want to take the really passive approach, I think look at the lead fund. So the lead fund typically does the most DD, and then the other funds that come after in a typical ICO traditionally will, you know, reduce their DD by 50 to 75% and just kind of trust whatever the lead fund did. I mean, that's just how things move so quickly in this market. So if you look at the fund and, you know, they're backed by Bitmain, they're backed by Binance, some big companies, then you can start thinking, okay, like probably not going to be a cash grab, run away with the money situation. It's not going to be the worst case scenario, largely, right? Could it still happen? Sure. But guess what? Then you have Binance's $10 billion war chest on your side, like going after these people. And it's comforting, it's just comforting. So, yeah, I mean, that's it. And the second one is like, look, like we always got on the phone with the founders, always.
Yeah.
We invest in nice sales, like always get our, and the more we know about the team and the founders on a personal level, the more comfortable we are investing. Most of them will take a half hour call, whether it's the head of partnership, strategy, a co-founder, technical founder, like you can get one of the head guys on the phone. I mean, that's standard practice.
Yeah.
And just pick their brain and be like, you know, you can just have a really open conversation, ask anything you want about the roadmap, where the project currently is, their plans for money, right? A lot of this would be publicly available. I think the goal is to get a little deeper and really feel out who you're talking to. A lot of times we would get opinions from the person we were talking to that maybe aren't public, right?
Gotcha.
Maybe they would say, well, yeah, we have a year in there, but realistically, you know, we're kind of budgeting maybe a couple extra months after, or we're planning to cut it down by this amount by, you know, exploring this solution. Right. And then it starts giving you like, okay, like they're actively thinking about this. That's a good sign, right? Like,
right.
It's not like just cookie cutter, which I think is problematic too, but.
Well, it's tough though. If they publish a roadmap on their website and they've got one guy who handles all the WordPress stuff, you know, and he did it 6 months ago and they've only been around for a year. That means 50% of the time that they've existed, their plan's been outdated. Cause the second you've
been outdated,
it's outdated.
Yeah.
So you get on the phone with them and then you're looking for consistency, like you said earlier. Okay, cool. And of course, if you figure out who the major players are, the lead fund, and say, look, what have they done? How much do I really need to do? So people should, if I'm hearing you right, they should really try to form some good relationships too within the whole blockchain economy before they start throwing their money at it just based on what they see online.
Yeah, 100%. And you know what? Ask the tough questions too.
Yeah.
Ask them how much their lead fund, what the discount is, and what the lockup is if it's a utility token raise, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like they might say, well, we can't publicize it, and say, okay, give us an average discount rate. What's the average that everybody's getting in the private sale? And what's the average lockup, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then you start knowing like, okay, is there the risk of a lead fund dumping upon listing, which is super common, or at least over, you know, the last 3 months it was. I think it's slowing down a little bit now.
Mm-hmm.
But lead funds sometimes would just jeopardize the whole campaign by instant dumping. And that's something you can't foresee, right? A lot of times companies get caught by surprise. And that's just a result of a market we're in and people are desperate and it's tough, but ask the tough questions. And if, you know, they don't want to give them to you, maybe move on. I mean, there's no shortage of projects these days. That's the beauty of this.
Yeah, true. If they won't give you answers, you don't give them your money. It's a simple,
simple as that, right?
Okay, that's cool. And you had mentioned partnerships before about something that could go wrong with a perfectly honest and well-intended company could have some partnerships fall through. And, you know, for what we do, we actually focus on developing strategic partnerships, very relationship oriented type of business. And I see that Block Team shares that emphasis because, as you said, it started out as a community, it still is a Block Team community. And then there is the venture side of it. So what kind of partnerships do you see being most valuable for you and the Block Team community in the future?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So we just signed a joint venture, I think it was publicized last week at Tokyo Unbound with Blockchain Industries. So this is a publicly traded company in LA. They have a merchant bank, they have hedge fund, they're on their second VC fund, advisory arm. So really, really awesome experienced group of guys and team that, you know, as first time fund managers, we, you know, looked at that opportunity as like, wow, we can join this experienced team and kind of, you know, combine forces, right? Resources, combine our networks, and then also learn from them too, and vice versa. You know, we're we might be a little younger, but they're just as active, right? Like conferences, going out, and combined, it makes this really interesting force. So we're going to be doing a joint fund with BCI. So this is an example of like, yeah, we can't go sign 10 of these at the same time, but a very targeted strategic partnership in the form of a joint venture that we think is a perfect match for what we're trying to accomplish moving forward. I think other ways are like, look, like start thinking of, I think fundraising and investor relations is super important right now. And there's a big gap. So a lot of companies, you know, they're looking for advisors to be fundraisers, which is never what it was really supposed to be on the advisory side. It was more of like, let me help you strategically, like build out, you know, your roadmap or strategic roadmap, marketing channels, budgets. Let us vet every proposal that comes your way. So to give a third party objective review, right? Like that's the value. And I think advisory, it quickly turned the last couple months is like, well, hey, come be an advisor. We don't need anything else. We need you to bring funds in and we'll pay you on commission. And I'm like, guys, like I'm in the US. I'm not a broker dealer. Mm-hmm. I'm not a licensed rep. I can't take commission on the back end. Oh, okay. Well, no, that's okay. We don't need anything. Okay, fine. Right. So I think when you're thinking about strategic partnerships is like helping companies access funds legally is super important, right? So that's connecting them with the right broker dealers or private placement agents. I think there's a big gap there. Who can they trust? What do the fee structures look like? And then on the second half, so that's kind of, I would say, pre-ICO, STO. The second half is user acquisition, right? What kind of partnerships are going to push forward the platform, the product, the ecosystem, and attract users and make it a win-win? And that's a vast playing field. I mean, that's where it gets interesting. And I think something, Colton, where like you guys would crush it as well is on that second half is super important. And just to validate, I think, your model, you know, I would say the second biggest ask I get behind investor relations stuff these days are partnerships, like connect us with the right people. So
that's good.
Definitely needed.
That's good news for us, you know, and I appreciate your insight on that because we look at it and I don't want to go and set up relationships between companies I don't understand with technologies I don't understand whose needs are not well defined. So I've been taking the time to read white papers, have these kinds of conversations. Even this podcast is a way for me to better understand the environment that I'm operating in. And, you know, when I hear that kind of feedback, it's helpful because particularly where you say there are a lot of restrictions being a US citizen, I'm American. We have a number of different things that limit us. And I've been helping people buy and sell profitable online businesses for a couple of years, which is a separate thing, but it's also a form of digital assets, right? The thing is, of course, you can't really call yourself a business broker in many states without being real estate.
Right.
And you can't sell the actual, you know, you can only sell the assets. But then once you say, well, I'll sell the company or shares in the company, well, then technically that's a whole other thing. You got Series 7 and all that. So yeah. There's a lot of ways to do it wrong and only a few ways to vaguely do it right. So there's limitations on that kind of thing. Getting compensated in different ways for helping people raise funds, again, it's a bit of a mess. But going in on the user acquisition side or helping them set up partnerships with other brands so they can help people actually spend or use the token that they've created. That's very interesting. And then the other thing is, of course, you're taking businesses that are operating and they're not crypto projects in the sense that it's not a software development project, but they're related to that space. So a media publication online that talks about blockchain stuff, that is a different kind of risk. And you can probably roll those up and you could do something where you're going to tokenize that and it becomes a security, then you have to go through the whole process in the US.
Sure.
So
sure.
It's interesting. I have to have these kind of conversations to find those pitfalls. So we do appreciate that info. And what I would ask you then is, given all of that, given that that is a difficult environment and you do have these kinds of different demands coming at you, mm-hmm. and you've worked on so many projects, what's your favorite deal story? Whether it was an interesting negotiation, clever application of leverage, good opportunity, or it was a total mess, almost went up in flames, melted down, whatever, and you were able to pull it off at the end. What would you say is your best one?
Yeah, good stuff. I'll give you two stories. Okay. First of them is on my personal side, how I got started in blockchain. I think it's hilarious, but it's true. Mm-hmm. I went on Upwork and I was working at a tech startup at that time doing product partnership. So pretty similar to what we're just talking about, helping external companies generate revenue by integrating them into the mobile app and web platform that we had at that time, right? So it was half product, half partnerships. Mm-hmm. And I'm just becoming obsessed during this process about cryptocurrencies and blockchain. So, you know, I go on Upwork and I'm like, okay, like I should start taking some weekend jobs or like after work jobs, like starting to get my feet wet. And I changed one word from tech to blockchain. And that was it. One word in my headline. I think I had like tech PR and marketing specialist or something, and I put blockchain PR and marketing specialist, and then it just like opened the floodgates. So I had like two contracts secured by that weekend. So within like 3 or 4 days, both of them agencies representing ICOs kind of early on. So that's how I got started. But yeah, a one word change professionally like led to the whole career path that I'm on now. So I think the takeaway there is just right place, right time, some dumb luck, just try things fall into place sometimes just by trying. I mean, on the deal side, I mean, you know, sadly enough, it's more negative than positive.
Really?
And it doesn't really fall on companies per se. It's more of people taking advantage of ICOs that have raised money. And I've come across, I mean, with one company alone, 4 or 5 blatant scam attempts where they've signed partnerships, paid for services, and other people just kind of disappear. And these are brand names. It's not like they're signing random situations, but like random companies and, you know, vague situations. These are like established companies over and over. I mean, I just had one yesterday where a really well-known marketing agency was hired, $25K a month, didn't deliver anything, half the people left, and like the company's trying to get their money back. And like, so yeah, I mean, I wish I had like a really awesome like awesome story. Look, I think it's after that happens once with a company, I mean, you tend to learn your lesson. So you kind of tighten up at that point and are a little more careful. I do think we're seeing, you know, this stems from like the 2017 Wild West environment. I think a lot of these companies are quickly going to get washed away, which is another reason, you know, plus for like STOs and more heavy regulation. Like, you know, if you come to the US and try to pull off a $1 million scam, like, you know, and it's a security and like investors get burned, like you have a mountain of people coming. Like, it's not good, right? Like, it's just not going to be good for many reasons. It's not going to be good. Most interesting deal. I mean, there's been a few, I'll give you an anecdotal story, which I think is cool. So I know a company that was doing an Asia roadshow for like 3 months back in the summer when it was kind of a hot thing, and they were everywhere, right? Like really, really hitting everything, putting in a lot of time, a lot of work. I think they were having decent success, a lot of soft commitments, nothing came in. So here's the thing. In Korea, the founder comes from the music industry, Korea Blockchain Week, skips all of the big events, goes to some local event, half the size, quarter the size, said he's the only non-Korean person in this venue, right? Okay. And he's 6'3", got the fitted hat, music industry, awesome guy, sticks out, right? Coming from the music industry, he's handing out flyers, just like you did in the 90s, right? Like handing out flyers. Come check out this, you know, and like nobody's doing that. Everybody's digital these days.
Right.
And so he catches the attention of some guy like, oh, like, what are you up to, you know? And the way he told me the story is like the guy didn't have a name tag on, kind of this vague Korean guy, spoke some English. Mm-hmm. The guy invites him out that night to dinner. Brings a couple of his friends. They go out, do the whole, you know, 5 a.m. Korea part of the initiation, right? You go out, you drink all night, you have fun, you go to dinner.
Right.
Apparently got 20 million from that group of people after that.
Wow.
So
good for him.
It's one of the, good for him. Amazing product.
Right.
Partnerships. I mean, the biggest musical artists you could think of are a part of this platform. So it's, you know, well-deserved, completely well-deserved. But it's just, I think the takeaway there is like, once again, it's kind of just be persistent, know your product, have the foundation set, try to build something real and be authentic. And then things kind of, not always, but they can fall into place. And I think in his case, it was a perfect example of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great story. You know, and all of them, the consistent story across that, and really this whole conversation seems to be just because it's digital, just because it's cryptographic, it's supposed to be trustless technology, it's still business. And fundamentally, if you can get out there in the real world, meet face to face, at least have a Skype call, like, it's still about the people. And you have to understand the motivations, the intent, background. And there's a lot of value in remembering that, you know, the internet is good for so many things, but building relationships, ironically, it's good to start them, but it's not necessarily the best way to flesh them out. So
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. Still a people game.
Yeah. So do you have any final words of wisdom on the topics of marketing, PR for blockchain projects, or anything else that you'd like to share with everybody listening right now?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, you know, I'm pretty critical about where the marketing spend is going these days, but I don't want people to get confused and think like, okay, we just got to like not market anything. I think you got to think of it in the terms of like branding, right? So at some point in the process, you're going to have to create a brand that attracts customers, whether it's B2C, B2B, you need users. Start early, right? I mean, that begins even during the ICO. You want that to be authentic. Mm-hmm. And the further along the process you are when you're doing your ICO, I would argue the stronger the ICO is going to be, or STO, whatever the case is, mm-hmm. the stronger your brand is. So yeah, don't look for like, I would call them 2017 hacks where like you get on some listing site and like 300,000 organic visitors like happen to click your website just because you're on this site. Like, doesn't work like that anymore.
Right.
Build a brand. Be a thought leader. If you're a CEO that, you know, has really good experience into something, do PR. I think PR is still important, right? Like, private investors want to see that publications are covering your project or excited about your project. That's a validation of like, you know, whether it's product market fit or what's to come. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, still think about that. You have to spend money for marketing. It's not free. I mean, there's creative ways to keep it low budget, but yeah, don't go out there and just like machine gun 35 different channels in this market. 6 months ago, maybe.
Right.
Still works. Now, no. So just be careful, but still allocate a marketing budget and build the brand. And I mean, that's, it goes back to traditional tech, right? This is, it's not easy. It takes time, but absolutely, it's important.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think a lot of times with, even, you know, coming from the perspective of partnership development, people will think, well, shouldn't that just be free? Can't you just introduce me to people and then I'll pay you later? It's like, well, kind of, but you know, there's a problem with that, which is we've got to decide who we're going to work with. You have to allocate the time. It is actually a little bit more time intensive than it seems. And then if I do set that up, I mean, you have to be prepared to potentially get on a plane, potentially go somewhere and be prepared to get to know the person. And that's not always cheap. So you have to have a budget.
You have to.
Yeah.
Oh, and I think second piece of advice.
Go ahead.
No,
you're the guest. Let's hear your second piece of advice.
No. If you're a service provider providing legitimate services to ICOs, companies in general, collect the money up front or put it in an escrow. Do not do delayed payments. Do not. I want to check my last LinkedIn post. Like, I'm chasing down 10 contracts right now because companies didn't liquidate their crypto or founders are just psychopaths. Like, it's shit.
Yeah.
And you know what? Like, that doesn't look good. And when it's me plus 10 other people and we start telling our networks about this, like it's
terrible.
Yeah. You know, it's terrible. And I mean, that's the problem. I think you had a lot of founders seeing the ICO gold rush and anticipating money coming in. So we hire these contractors, we do this, we do that. And then the market tanks and like, they don't have the money coming in. And then they have like 200K in outstanding balances they have to cover. And it's like, it's not a good position, right? So that's what I would recommend. Structure everything. Any private placement agent that fundraises legally in the US takes a service fee. Mm-hmm. Usually it's 20 to 30K a month just to get motivated to go out and contact their network. So for strategic partnerships, like, no, it's absolutely reasonable to ask for something to, you know, you're going to be spending time on it. You should be compensated for that time.
Absolutely.
And put it in an escrow. I mean, don't be me and have to like chase down 10 people.
I worked very briefly in debt collection, just for normal consumer debts. It's terrible, you know, and that's your job. That's horrible then. So just imagine, you know, trying to chase down people who you like, you know, even if you like them, you worked with them, and it's still so awkward. And I actually learned this from somebody recently. I was at a little conference in Singapore and they said, look, people will always find a reason to screw you. And they'll talk themselves into it. You know, they're not choosing not to pay you. Like, I'm just going to rip that guy off. They'll talk themselves into it. Like, I didn't like the way he looked at me. His tone was weird. And he never really did what he said he was going to do. And so I'm just not going to pay him. I'm not going to take his calls. Even though if we have a contract, he can come in.
Yeah. Right. Guess what? Guess who has the power now?
Right.
Founder.
The guy with
We're in a community driven ecosystem now.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and a lot of these companies are going after equity raises and want to legitimize themselves. Like,
Right.
Do you really want like 10 people? I'm not saying this is a threat or anything. I'm just saying, like, do you want somebody like you, Colton, or me with my network to like go out there and say, hey, be careful with this company because they don't settle their debt or they don't care right. about your workers? Like, do you want that stigma? So I would argue, like, yeah, in the back in the day, like, an insolvent company could just run away. But like these days, no. And guess what? Like, people like that get screwed are not going to stop like exposing. Right. Like, your next venture is going to be tarnished because of that. Like, it's just not smart. And look, I say that as somebody that has complete sympathy for an ICO that didn't raise the money they expected, right? I have a couple of those. I'm not even mad. We, you know, the initial couple payments came in. Mm-hmm. It didn't go as well. The market sucks. I sympathize. No problem. Right. But like blatant attempts not to pay? No, that's not going to happen.
Right. That's something where it's kind of, you understand from an investor's perspective or from a service provider's perspective, you understand clients, vendors, customers, partners go out of business. They declare bankruptcy. They have to have difficult calls with their employees or with their investors and say, hey, look, mm-hmm. it didn't work out. And if somebody is working with a company that barely has a business, you know, it's an expensive widget. You know, they have very little coming right. in. Or the ones who did a fundraise and they're going to go build it now. You always know there's a chance. You want them to act professional about it. And like, hey, we just can't continue. We can't pay you. We'll try in the future. And you know, when they say they'll try in the future, usually that means you'll never see it. But at least they had the, you know, they had what it took to just say, hey, look, we're not going to be able to do it right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Or minimal. Even like minimal. Yeah. I mean, like, maybe you agree, Colton, but like, you know, like the people I know that are in these scenarios, the truth is, for the ones that are really like, you know, in a tough spot, they would accept payment plans. A lot of them would accept pennies on the dollar. Like, you know, give us 25% of what you owe us and like, we'll call it a day. Like, we just need to cover our expenses that went into this thing. Right. So maybe we don't make a margin on it, but look, we break even. We continue a good relationship. That's it.
Right.
There's so many solutions, but yeah, the ghosting mentality is like, what drives me crazy. And it's just, it's not right. It's just not right.
You got to be able to look people in the eye. You know, you're going to see them at a conference or something, and you can only burn so many people before you can't show your face anymore.
Yeah. Terrible. That's it.
So now that we've definitely kind of dug into the good and the bad and some of the ugliness of what's out there, it sounds like what you're doing at Block Team is really great. You've got this new partnership going. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Get in touch with you or Block Team in general. How can they help you and how can they find out about how you can help them?
Yeah, great. So Block Team, I think realistically it's going to take us some time to get this joint venture in place. So probably, you know, a month or two, probably realistically Q1 is when we'll start deploying capital again, if I had to put a timeline on it. But we're at blockteam.io. My personal email, jared@blockteam.io. So very open to connecting with people. I think, yeah, with us is we've, you know, the whole founding team, me, Simon, Jesse, Chip, another venture partner, and then the guys at BCI, we're all extremely hands-on, right? So the projects we've worked with, like, we get in the weeds, right? We're executing, you know, marketing for them. We're building things out. We're introducing them to people. It's not like we sign a check and like, hey, good luck. We consider ourselves strategic partners. So I think that's what differentiates us. We've all come from this world, like, as executors. So, you know, we're not like just venture capitalists that, you know, a lot of VCs have hands-on experience. So I just want to make that clear. But like, prior, right? They exit a company, they go become a VC, but no, we keep that mentality. We're really hands-on. So yeah, we would love to connect with anybody that, even like yourself, that, you know, provides a service that maybe we don't have or that we could definitely use for our clients that, you know, helps build out not only their product, but the ecosystem in general too. So, I mean, I think that's one way. And then, we're going to be looking for a lot of interesting projects here starting, you know, early next year. So if you have a project, reach out, we're happy to have a look. Other than that, I mean, completely open, open ideas.
Great. Well, thank you for taking the time today. Everything you shared was very helpful. Everybody listening right now, once again, this is Jared Politis of Block Team Ventures, and you can reach out to him and, you know, open up those ideas and those discussions. Really appreciate you coming out today. Thank you.
Thanks, Colton. I appreciate it. Thanks, everyone.
All right. Thank you for listening to the Pendulum Insight Podcast. If you learned something today and you want to know more, go check out PendulumInsight.com.